Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author Nicholas J.S. Davies, who assesses President Obama's plan to escalate the Afghan war by looking at failed past attempts by a succession of colonial powers to occupy the impoverished country. Activist Matthew Lewis Rosenberg, who talks about the dangerous conditions in Appalachian coalfield communities and what coal companies must do to rectify the problem. And author and columnist David Lindorf, who discusses the work of a British commission now investigating former Prime Minister Tony Blair's decision to support President Bush's 2003 invasion of Iraq. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Facing intense international criticism, Sri Lanka has begun to release 130,000 ethnic Tamil people held in internment camps since May, when the 26-year insurgency by the rebel Tamil Tigers collapsed. Sri Lanka had insisted the Tamils needed to be held to check for rebel ties and to give the government time to clear mines from the conflict zone. Sri Lankan President Menanda Rajapaksa has scheduled a presidential election to capitalize on his popularity for January 2010. A report by aid workers who visited the resettled refugees stated, "We witnessed many families reduced to women, very young children, and old people who lack sufficient shelter, transport, health care, or schools." The released detainees are given $437 by the United Nations and receive food rations for a year. Amnesty International praised the lifting of restrictions on Tamil detainees, but urged full access for human rights monitors to the existing camps to ensure their needs are being met, including that they are protected against further human rights violations. 25 years after the deadly toxic leak at the Bhopal chemical plant run by Union Carbide, Indian officials are opening up the plant for public tours. The chemical leak at the factory killed over 15,000 people in Bhopal in 1984. Babula Garg, who heads up the Indian government's relief program for the Bhopal victims, explained, "Just like we go to Hiroshima, Chernobyl, and Ground Zero in New York to remember and pray for the victims, so many people in the world will want to visit the Bhopal factory to learn about the disaster." However, activists like Totara Chahan maintains the factory is still contaminated and unsafe. In 1989, Union Carbide settled out of court with the Indian government for $470 million. Bhopal victim advocates complain injured people only received $500 each in compensation. Advocates are pushing for a full cleanup paid for by Dow Chemical, which purchased Union Carbide in 2001. Victims activist Abdul Jabbar says the government-led tours is only a sideshow, ignoring long-standing issues of inadequate compensation for victims, poor health care, and meager services for the permanently disabled. 15 Pennsylvania families claiming their drinking water was contaminated by a natural gas driller have filed suit in federal court in Scranton, Pennsylvania, to halt drilling activity near the town of Dimock. The families have targeted driller Cabot Oil and Gas and are seeking to halt drilling near the Marcellus Shale Formation that covers a large section of Pennsylvania and New York State. The plaintiffs are also seeking a trust fund to pay for medical expenses for treatment of neurological and gastrointestinal ailments. According to ProPublica, the lawsuit alleges Cabot allowed methane and heavy metals to seep into drinking water wells, and the driller acted fraudulently when it claimed chemicals used in the drilling process called hydraulic fracturing would not contribute to groundwater contamination. Cabot employee Nolan Scott Eli is among the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. In January, a well of one of Eli's relatives caught fire after methane leaked into the well. Over the last year, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection found that Cabot was responsible for several spills of diesel fuel and an 800-gallon leak of fracturing chemicals. The plaintiffs are seeking to cover the cost of health care and health monitoring, plus compensation for the decline in their property values. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Emily Santos Poplowski.
After weeks of consulting with his advisors and the Pentagon, President Obama announced his administration's new strategy on the Afghan war in a nationally televised address from West Point Military Academy December 1st. The plan calls for the deployment of an additional 30,000 American troops over the next 6 months and a timetable to withdraw most U.S. soldiers within 3 years. Obama plans to step up the training of Afghan forces to take over their own nation's security. Public opinion polls reveal widespread opposition to expansion of the war among Americans. The peace movement organized anti-war protests across the country to respond to the Obama speech. In the Senate, Democrat Russell Feingold of Wisconsin and independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont have pledged to block congressional authorization of the White House plan to escalate the Afghan war. In a recently published article, Why Afghans Dig Empire Graveyards, Nicholas J. S. Davies recounts the multiple unsuccessful attempts by a succession of colonial powers to occupy Afghanistan. The strategic geographic location of Afghanistan for building critical oil pipelines may have as much to do with U.S. designs on the country as the potential threat posed by the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Davies about the current conflict in the context of Afghan history and his view of President Obama's plan to escalate the war.
In the 19th century, the early 19th century, the Russian Empire was gradually growing and expanding into the Caucasus and Central Asia. And so the British, on the other side of the Khyber Pass there in what is now Pakistan, became concerned that the Russians eventually could be driving south and threatening their control of what's now Pakistan and India. The British, really out of fear of what might happen if they didn't, moved into Afghanistan and suffered, you know, just an absolutely dreadful, dreadful defeat. They stayed in Kabul for a couple of years, couldn't control any more of Afghanistan than the capital. You know, this is very familiar with what's going on today. And eventually they basically had to beat a retreat, but they all got massacred on the way out of the country. During the Cold War, the United States was so determined to oppose leftist governments anywhere in the world that it supported anyone who would oppose them. But in the process of that, it allied itself with you know, really extreme forces of religious fundamentalism and forces that are so conservative that people here now throw up their hands at the way they behave. When people look at Saudi Arabia or the Taliban, but we supported and gave strength and power and funding to all of these radically conservative forces. And the Taliban and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan are no exception. I'm sure Obama will justify our involvement in Afghanistan based on the presence of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, but we should remember that our involvement in Afghanistan predates and actually served to bring these movements into being. And so I think it's important for all of us as Americans to ask more fundamental questions about what we're doing there, especially when we think about what's going to happen if we pull out. Because, you know, what is it that our government is really afraid of? They were quite content to do business with the Taliban in the 1990s. Even the Bush administration, when they first came to office, was continuing negotiations with the Taliban regarding oil pipelines and things like that. So, you know, I think we need to be skeptical about efforts by our government and our political and media establishment to try and persuade us that that is what our involvement in Afghanistan is all about.
What do you think the priority here is for the United States, and how real is the al-Qaeda threat?
Well, the al-Qaeda threat does exist, but that threat does not come from Afghanistan. The attacks of September the 11th were planned in Hamburg and, you know, close to where I am, in Delray Beach, Florida, and places like that. The United States responded opportunistically to the attacks of September the 11th. You know, our operations in Iraq and Afghanistan fit into a larger effort to extend our military power and military control essentially over the whole world. I mean, since the fall of the Soviet Union, the main thrusts of our foreign policy have been to militarily occupy and build bases wherever oil is produced and shipped around the world, and to surround Russia with U.S. allies and U.S. bases. Essentially, the reason that we now have the largest military budget since World War II is because our government simply cannot clearly define its own objectives. So its military objectives are essentially unlimited and opportunistic. By trying to build bases everywhere and establish military control everywhere, all around the world, our government has essentially lost the goodwill of the world and set itself an unachievable task.
President Obama's plan is to send 30,000 or more U.S. troops to Afghanistan, in addition to the 21,000 he's already sent there last March, doubling the number of U.S. forces on the ground there. What are the repercussions, in your view, of President Obama's policy?
With sufficient propaganda, they may, as they did with, you know, the so-called surge in Iraq, which essentially meant, you know, we conducted more airstrikes for a while and deployed more JSOC, Special Operations Forces, to go and bump people off. And, you know, we really engaged in an orgy of violence for about a year or a year and a half under the so-called surge. And then we stopped. And, oh, the violence stopped. But, you know, I mean, it was we who stopped. It wasn't that we actually defeated the insurgency. We bought a lot of them off, and then we stopped attacking them. So yes, the violence quieted down. So, you know, I mean, we could do something similar in Afghanistan, and, you know, maybe some Americans will, at the end of the day, believe as people believe that, oh, the surge succeeded in Iraq, maybe some people will end up believing that the surge succeeded in Afghanistan. But, you know, when we're the ones who are responsible for most of the violence, we are the ones who are the foreign invaders in the country, you know, we essentially control the levers of the level of violence. So, yeah, I'm not saying that, there may at some point be a successful public relations campaign to say that this was successful, but ultimately the end result is not going to be any different, which is that we will eventually leave and the Afghans will eventually get on with their lives.
That was Nicholas J.S. Davies, author of the forthcoming book, Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq. Read Davies' article, Why Afghans Dig Empire Graveyards, online at consortiumnews.com. While the pace of civil disobedience actions against the mining of coal are picking up in Appalachia, they are also spreading to parts of the country where coal is burned in power plants. One action on November 30th attempted to stop a new coal-fired plant in South Carolina from opening. Coal creates huge environmental and public health hazards, both at the sites of extraction and combustion, producing severe water and air pollution. A little-known fact is that one of the byproducts of coal production is billions of gallons of toxic coal slurry, which is injected into abandoned and underground mine sites deep inside Appalachian Mountains. This has led to contamination of residents' well water and scores of serious illnesses and deaths. Activists charge this has led to contamination of residents' well water and scores of serious illnesses and deaths. While no cause and effect relationship has been scientifically established, it's clear that heavy metals in drinking water damage human health. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Matt Lewis Rosenberg, who works on the Coal Sludge Safety Project, sponsored by Coal River Mountain Watch, a community organization in West Virginia that works to stop mountaintop removal mining. The problem of coal sludge occurs with all types of mining, and there are currently 113 slurry impoundments in the state. The activist says local residents are learning to speak out in favor of legislation to clean up the mining process. Here, Lewis Rosenberg talks about the dangerous conditions in coal field communities and what coal companies must do to rectify the problem.
In order for coal to be sold at market, it has to be washed of impurities, both non-combustibles that, you know, reduce the quality of the coal, and toxins, which make it higher emissions coal, which the power companies don't want to buy because then they have to spend the money to scrub it out in order to meet Clean Air Act standards. So, especially with the strengthening of the Clean Air Act, there was a demand for cleaner and cleaner coal from the power companies. So in order to wash this coal, they use a float sink process, which is these enormous, they look like silos, called thickeners. What they'll do is they'll take the raw coal and put it in with an enormous quantity of water and then add a bunch of chemicals to that water in order to make the coal float and the not coal sink to the bottom. You know, quote unquote, the clean coal comes off the top. What's left is this enormous quantity of wastewater. And so this wastewater has the chemicals that they use in this process, a lot of which are patented, and therefore we don't even know exactly what they are. And then there's really very high levels of heavy metals, which have been washed out of the coal as impurities. And many of these heavy metals are toxic, and many are not necessarily toxic in and of themselves, but at the levels that you find them in coal slurry, they are toxic. So we're talking about arsenic, lead, aluminum, manganese, iron, mercury, you know, selenium, and the list kind of goes on. It has pretty much the whole suite of heavy metals in it. So the biggest public health risk in terms of coal slurry contaminating groundwater is primarily from these toxic heavy metals. And the health impacts that we have seen in the communities where, you know, residents suspect that the groundwater has become contaminated by coal slurry are just, you know, horrific. Prenter is the community that I have worked most closely with, so I sort of know more about this, that community than some of the others. But, you know, we've done health surveys and found, depending on exactly which group of people we talk to, anywhere from 60 to 90% of the people that we have talked to have had their gallbladders removed, have gallbladder disease. You know, we're talking about, you know, maybe a 500-foot stretch of road, something like that. There were 8 diagnosed brain tumors, including people in their 20s dying of brain tumors. We just had a kid, 24 years old, die of kidney cancer in this community. We have seen, you know, 5-year-old kids with basically no teeth left because the water has corroded their teeth away. We've seen 14-year-old girls with urinary tract infections so bad they had to be hospitalized that they stopped getting when they stopped bathing in the water.
How does the project go about organizing, and what kind of success have you had?
The Sludge Safety Project does sort of very traditional boots on the ground community organizing in communities that are directly affected by coal slurry, and, you know, has fought quite a number of very local struggles around particular community concerns. In that very first fight over that impoundment, you know, they lost the fight over the impoundment got built, but they got a reverse 911 system put in the county so that if there ever was a problem, everyone would be notified in their homes, and fought to sort of improve disaster response should something happen, and won some victories there. Worked with the town of Rawl, where the groundwater was contaminated by slurry injection, where they take this toxic waste product and pump it into old underground mines. Well, in the Rawl area, that got into people's well water. People were extremely sick, and a Sludge Safety Project organized with them. They got a water line put in. There's an ongoing lawsuit. Very similar work was done in Prenter, West Virginia, which is in Boone County. They also got a water line. There's also an ongoing lawsuit there, and in Prenter also helped kickstart a community project to deliver emergency clean drinking water until such time as a water line could be laid.
I know the Sludge Safety Project finds or develops community leaders who then have gone to the state legislature to push for changes in the production and regulation of coal slurry. But what are you asking or demanding that the coal companies do?
To stop coal slurry doesn't mean stopping all coal mining. It means asking the industry to bear a very small additional cost per ton in order to dispose of the waste more safely.
That was Matt Lewis Rosenberg of the Sludge Safety Project, sponsored by Coal River Mountain Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 304-854-2182 or visit their website at crmw.net. Last week, a British commission established by Prime Minister Gordon Brown launched an inquiry into the circumstances surrounding former Prime Minister Tony Blair's decision to support President Bush's 2003 invasion of Iraq. The inquiry, headed by former civil servant Sir John Chilcutt, has gathered information that indicated Blair was told by his government's most senior legal advisor that an invasion of Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein would be a serious breach of international law and the UN Charter. News leaked from the commission to the British press has revealed that Blair's government lied to Parliament and the public about the country's involvement in war planning that had begun early in 2002. Sir William Erman, former Director General of Defense and Intelligence at Britain's Foreign Office, testified that on the eve of the Iraq War, intelligence chiefs told Mr. Blair that the Iraqi dictator had no warheads capable of delivering chemical weapons. Yet the former prime minister gave the go-ahead for the invasion, despite strong evidence that Iraq was no threat to Britain. This inquiry is a natural follow-up to the Downing Street memos, leaked to the British press in 2005. The memos revealed notes made by the head of Britain's MI6 spy agency, recounting his July 2002 visit to Washington, where he was told that President Bush was planning to remove Saddam Hussein from power, but that the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and columnist Dave Lindorf, who discusses the work of the British Commission's current investigation into the origins of the Iraq War.
What's happened in Britain, and it's something that I doubt could happen here, is that the public pressure, supported by intense media pressure, forced the government of Gordon Brown to appoint this commission to investigate the origins of British involvement in the war in Iraq. You'd like to think the same thing could happen here, but we don't really have a mass media that does journalism anymore, so it's kind of tough. Opposition to the war was more pronounced in Britain from day one and continues to this day to be greater and greater. So the pressure mounted, and Gordon Brown was forced to authorize the formation of this Chilcot Commission, which does not have the power to enforce people to testify under oath or anything, but what it is managing to do is bring out the rich detail of how much deception went on in the Blair administration over the need to go to war. And also, from our perspective, it lays out what the U.S. was doing to gin up for a war and to hammer Britain into supporting it.
What evidence has come forward, Dave, that sheds light on what President Bush and Tony Blair were up to that was not known previously?
Well, people are coming forward who played actual roles in the buildup, so that you have the intelligence director for the Foreign Office, for example, I think Sir Walter Ehrman, if I've got it right, E-H-R-M-A-N, who was the director of General Defense and Intelligence in the Foreign Office, saying, well, several things. He said that 10 days before the invasion, when Blair was saying, we have to go in, he's about, you know, to where this 45 minutes warning is all we'd get, you know, before missiles could hit Britain. In fact, he was being told by this director of intelligence for the Foreign Office, that Saddam Hussein had dissembled all his chemical weapons and had no biological weapons, and that he had, even if he hadn't, that there were no delivery systems. He had no missiles that could deliver any warheads. So in other words, he's saying Blair was flat-out lying to the public. We had a report that in 2002, Blair was at Crawford Ranch with Bush telling him that he would be prepared to go to war with Saddam Hussein to topple Hussein. So obviously he was being told, the other side of that conversation was, you know, Bush saying that we're going to go to war and would you join us? And meanwhile, Blair testified in July to a parliamentary committee that there were no plans to go to war with Iraq. So that was a flat-out lie. So these are actual statements being made by people who were having these conversations with Blair. So it's not a document that's open to interpretation. It's not, I heard someone say that. You know, these are the actual participants who were talking with Blair.
Why is it important, do you think, that we uncover what really happened in the lead-up to the Iraq War? Many people had been clamoring for the impeachment of President Bush so there could be investigative hearings in Congress to really get to the bottom of why this nation went to war with Iraq when all the pretexts were found to be false. Why is it important now in 2009, 2010 to really revisit this whole case?
Well, we're getting the same thing happening all over again with Afghanistan. And the reason that the story of Iraq is so important is not, I would argue, not so much the criminality of Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and those guys, although they certainly deserve richly to spend the rest of their lives in jail for the crimes they committed. It's that it's really the failure of the media and the failure of Congress to do their jobs for falling in line with this corrupt behavior that got us into the Iraq War in the first place, and that they're doing it again. You know, they're falling in line on Afghanistan. They're buying the line that this is a necessary war, that it's Al-Qaeda and terrorism. We're fighting a continuation of 2001, and it has nothing to do with that. So that's why it's important to get to the bottom of the Iraq thing.
That was Dave Lindorf, columnist and co-author, along with Barbara Olshansky, of The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. Read his article about the British inquiry at the website thiscan'tbehappening.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at detailonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Emily Santos-Poplowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.